John Williams, head of ShadowStats.com, an alternative economic resource. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
How's the weather in that part of California today?
Well, it's sunny up in the San Francisco area. Been having some storms recently, but it's a nice day today, and presumably that weather's going to be moving to the east.
That wasn't really a topic for today's discussion, but from what I'm reading through several sources, we're hearing that San Francisco might be peaking in its housing boom there, the echo bubble. Any quick comments there?
I think you're seeing that happening in a number of areas. The real estate market is hasn't been as strong as it's been estimated. And if you look at the aggregate data, if you look at the existing home sales, the new home sales, housing starts, construction spending, you know, there's been some upward movement. If you smooth it out over 6 months, you're seeing basically a low level of stagnation. When I say low level, this is in contrast to where you were before the Great Recession. Generally, you're down, depending on the series, anywhere from 20 to 40% below the pre-recession peak, which is not exactly a fully recovered economy. In fact, the way the numbers generally are defined, if you look at the business cycle, a recession is when the economy starts to turn down from what then becomes a pre-recession peak and falls till it hits a bottom and then starts to rise. The bottom is the trough, and then as it starts to rise, that's referred to as a recovery. But you really don't get into economic expansion, at least as economic expansion has been traditionally defined, until you recover above the pre-recession peak. So what you're seeing in the housing market is indeed there's been some recovery, but we haven't seen an expansion there in well over a decade, and you see it in other series such as the manufacturing sector. There you have now 123 months, a little over 10 years of non-economic expansion, and what's interesting with that is that it's the manufacturing series is part of industrial production, is it has a 100-year history behind it. And in the 100-year history of the series, you've never seen such a protracted period of non-economic expansion. This is going back to 1918, post-World War I. Now, the production headline production series has recovered, and that is due to an expanding expanding mining sector, particularly oil and gas drilling and extraction. But even there, with all the boom that's being reported in that area, industrial production is it's only 1% or so above its pre-recession peak. And if you follow the industrial production, it troughed and then it actually recovered and hit its prior peak at the end of 2014. You had a recovery of a couple of months, or an expansion of a couple of months, expansion of a full quarter, and then it turned down again. In the benchmark revisions that we saw last month, that recovery in 2000, that recovery or that brief recovery, expansion remained intact. But what disappeared was the most recent numbers of industrial production had, after they'd fallen off there, had actually regained the 2014 level. That disappeared. That sank down. So that in that benchmark revision, you lost the recovery from what probably was a double dip recession, as they would formally look at it, but it was never defined as such. You've never had a protracted series of annual declines in industrial production and not been in formal recession except this this period after 2014. Nonetheless, as it stands now in the revisions that were published this last week, production again has regained its level of at the end of 2014. But again, it's you're not seeing anything close to what's reported with the headline GDP, which I think is a very heavily gimmicked number. Right there, the GDP is up over 15% from its pre-recession peak. But I can't find a quality series that reflects anything close to that. Again, industrial production is, you know, maybe a percent or two. Manufacturing is down 5.4% from its pre-recession peak. All the housing numbers are down 10 to 20% from their peak. If you look at retail sales, which had a bad quarter, just contracted year-to-year after inflation, quarter-to-quarter after inflation. That series is overstated because when you look at an inflation-adjusted number, what's key there is what kind of an inflation rate you use. The reason you use an inflation rate, if you look at your retail sales before adjusting for inflation, the nominal term, as they call it, let's say that's up 5%. But if inflation were up 5%, then what that means is that all your sales gain was in inflation. You're not moving a higher volume of goods. So if you look at it net of inflation, you get an idea of the physical movement of goods if you're selling more goods. The way the government reports inflation, they understate inflation. They understate consumer inflation. And if you use too low a rate of inflation as they use here, that tends to overstate the real growth, the inflation-adjusted growth. But even so, you're not looking, you're maybe up 5 to 7% from pre-recession peak. You're not up 15%. I mean, that's the GDP, that's just nonsense. Adding to the good news, you have a widening trade deficit. That generally gets subtracted from GDP activity. So with everything that's happening here, even though the GDP growth is overstated, you're likely going to see a pretty good slowing in the growth rate for the first quarter of this year. That'll be announced next week. I think it could even be a contraction. Part of that's due to storm distortions that boosted fourth quarter activity. But when you get all the benchmark revisions in place, I think you're going to see that the first quarter GDP actually did contract and that we're probably in a new recession.
Let's shift over to the commodities sector. This has been uneventful, unfortunately, for many years amid the backdrop of an unfavorable global economic situation where essentially paper assets, let's just say in vogue and hard assets, lost the attention of the deep pockets in most investors. Well, that appears to be changing rapidly. We look at the commodities sector, the CRB is perking up. West Texas leading the charge, approaching $70 and probably much higher. We also see gold near multi-year highs, the XAU showing signs of life, and even silver topping 17 recently. We have a number we haven't seen in a long time.
Commodities do tend to move. Certain commodities, such as oil, will tend to move with economic activity. But that's also a commodity because of how it's produced globally that's very sensitive to the value of the dollar. And what you've been seeing there is that the Fed has artificially propped the dollar in recent years. That's beginning to fall apart. And as the dollar weakens, you see stronger oil prices. That is there's an inverse relationship there that's a long-range correlation of about 80%. So generally, as the dollar weakens, oil in particular rises, and oil is and its derivative products are primary generators of our domestic inflation. So that as the dollar weakens and the oil prices rise, you should start to see some pickup in our headline inflation. And my contention is you're going to see got good risk of a dollar panic here as the Fed continues to run into trouble. They still haven't been able to bring the system under adequate control following the near banking collapse in 2028. And that is, as the economy weakens here, I think they're going to move back towards the quantitative easing, and that in turn will clobber the dollar, spike commodity prices, such as oil, that move contrary to the dollar, and with domestic inflation on the rise, be very bullish for the precious metals, gold and silver, which are your best hedges long-term for preserving the purchasing power of your wealth and assets. So, yeah, I see generally a market here that's going to become very bullish for gold and silver, but it's in the context of bad news of higher inflation for the people in the United States.
The threat of a trade war with China, a lot of saber rattling, the administration very upset with them, and then suddenly we find out that most of those trade tariffs were really smoke and mirrors is really what it amounted to. I mean, obviously China, our number one trading partner, but we don't want to do too much to upset the apple cart. Give us an idea of how these tariffs might impact, especially the domestic economy.
Anything that will raise the cost of the imports will tend to be inflationary. But you have a circumstance where indeed there's a lot of smoke and mirrors and huffing and puffing here. Trade deficit is a very serious problem. We've got a good shot here in the next week of seeing the worst quarterly trade deficit net of inflation that's ever been seen. Generally, it's bad news for the dollar. It's bad news for the economy. It reflects a lot of economic loss of jobs offshore, production offshore, wealth offshore. It's one reason that the electorate was disgruntled at the time of the last presidential election and helped President Trump get elected. I think he's indeed looking at addressing that trade area. We've had terrible trade deals, and people have had all sorts of motives for putting them in place. Whether they're going to be meaningfully addressed remains to be seen. I don't think anyone's going to collapse the global economy over it. I think that what's going back and forth is largely negotiation. You'll get some deals that'll improve the circumstance a little bit to the extent there's tariffs. Again, that adds to inflation. But consider, this is just something that doesn't really have a happy solution for everyone as to how you look at it. But one reason that we have this problem is that the cost of producing goods and doing business in the United States is so expensive. I mean, if you look at putting aside for a moment just our cost of labor, all the benefits, all the safety features that have to be in production, all the product liability issues that arise for people who manufacture goods here, the insurance costs, benefits costs, the health costs, they're extremely high. They're beneficial for the, what the problem is, your products lose their competitiveness in the world markets. I'll give you an example. I used to have a company that manufactured abrasive wheels in Michigan. We had a product liability issue there where somebody got injured with a grinding wheel that they claimed we had made. They couldn't show that it was made by us. The insurance company handled the case, and I was a little naive at the time, but they settled it. They gave a fellow $20,000 for having lost his help. He dropped the product. He couldn't show that it was our product. Nonetheless, they settled. But then they canceled our insurance. The cost of replacing that insurance took it from something like 0.07 of a percent of our sales to 7% of our sales. I mean, it put us out of business. It's very difficult to compete manufacturing in the U.S. environment against the rest of the world where you have such low labor costs, low cost in terms of the benefits for the workers, a lot of protection against the liability suits in the United States is if you want to get a product made in the United States on a competitive basis with, let's say, an Asian country, which doesn't have all the environmental standards, work standards, and such that we have. One way of trying to put things on a parallel basis is with a tariff. The point there is say, hey, look, we've decided this is the way we want our world to be. We want workers to be treated in a good manner. We want products to be safe and for companies to take liability for things that they make mistakes on. And if you want to change your environment so that you're on parallel with us, then, the tariff's not needed. But as long as we're competing in this environment, we need a tariff. There's an inequality there in the global system where the decisions that have been made by the U.S. government, legislative bodies and courts and such, have said this is what's correct, this is what we need, but it becomes uncompetitive when you try to trade in the rest of the world. So how do you balance that out? And that's, again, at this point in time, it would be tariffs.
The Federal Reserve meeting comments late last Wednesday seemed quite hawkish relative to earlier comments. I mean, there's concerns over the growth that you alluded to and higher prices, i.e. inflation. Obviously, we're going to have much higher rates. This will have a detrimental impact on many areas of the economy, especially, of course, housing. You have a huge component of the economic recovery clearly in the housing sector, and the Fed funds futures now are alluding to a couple of more rate hikes at least. This should put rates, it looks like, in the neighborhood of 3.75% and higher in the next year or so. Give us your idea on just how this might impact the markets as well as the economy, please.
The higher rates indeed are not good for the housing market. As I mentioned earlier, the housing market still hasn't recovered. The banking system hasn't recovered. The Fed has never been able to work out its system since it bailed out the banks and literally bailed out the system, preventing an economic collapse. Although we did have something pretty close to an economic collapse, it was not quite as bad as it could have been. They guaranteed all deposits. They bailed out whatever had to be bailed out. They bailed out General Motors. The Fed purchased AIG, which is the world's largest insurance company, that was providing insurance on these bad mortgage-backed securities that were bringing the banking system down. They flooded the system with liquidity, but they wouldn't let the banks lend it out into the economy, which might have helped the economy. They deposit the cash you're getting from the Fed back with the Fed, and the Fed paid the bank's interest. It's never been stabilized. They haven't worked it out, and that's still a problem around the world. And one thing that we saw in the recession that we had and the economic weakness, stagnation that I contend we have now, they've never been able to bring the system under control. They sacrificed economic growth to preserve the banking system. They probably should have scrapped the banking system and restructured that, and you might have had a basis for positive growth going forward. But until this all works out, and I think it doesn't work out with without a major crash in the system, you're not going to get normal economic growth as people are used to it.
Be remiss if I didn't mention U.S. equities. Obviously, volatility has increased markedly. We've seen the VIX and the VIX derivative surprisingly high levels, which has been extremely detrimental to the short volatility trade, which was really the go-to moneymaker for many years. Well, that backfired in a huge way, blowing up several funds and ETFs in the process. It all seemed to begin with that U.K. construction firm, which imploded and was the number one short company all throughout Europe. They've proven now, the hedge funds and the institutions recognize that even the powers that be knew that it was doomed. Do you believe that we've seen the peak?
Oh, that's tough to, well overvalued and don't see it having a happy ending. I think what the proximal trigger will be a misstep by the Fed trying to prop up the banking system further as the economy weakens. What they have to watch out for, and you're beginning to see it, and it's also affecting the pricing of oil and gold, is weakness in the dollar. If you get a massive sell-off in the dollar, and I think that'll be the proximal trigger, that'll also reflect a flight of foreign capital from the U.S. equity markets as well as the credit markets, which would tend to push rates higher. But as the capital comes out of the stock market, that'll be reflected in heavy selling. That's what gave us a crash in 1987. That was a misstep. We had a very weak dollar at the time. We'd been propping it up. Here the Fed's been taking actions to prop it up as well, at least in jawboning interest rates. Coming into that weekend before the crash in 87, James Baker's and Treasury Secretary made a comment to the effect that the U.S. is no longer going to support the dollar against the Deutsche Mark. I'd been in trading currencies for a while and knew that was going to give you a massive sell-off in the dollar, which happened. And with that, the capital also fled from the stock market. And I think that's a type of circumstance you're going to see here. You have a lot of foreign capital in the markets here. As that leaves the U.S., there's enough of it to be the balance between holding the market where it is and a plunge. And I think this is going to end in some kind of a selling panic, both of the dollar and of the U.S. stocks. And the flight generally would be to the hard assets such as gold.
Now there is an alternative for the BRICS nations in particular. China launches what some folks are referring to as the death knell for the petrol arrangement. Goldback yuan oil contract trading heavily and with the full support of the PBOC. So give us your idea on the significance of this new exchange, whether or not this will have a major impact or if you see it as merely an anomaly.
Well, it certainly could have the it certainly can have major impact. I mean, the yuan is now a reserve currency, but its relative volume in the markets is still small. That can change rapidly. But I'd watch. I mean, if you see the volume of it growing in the markets, then what you're looking at there would be a major threat to the dollar. Long term, that may be a case here, but I think we're going to have the panic here triggered for more standard things before that comes into play.
And lastly, really should mention the potential impact of the crypto revolution on global currencies. I mean, obviously right now, relative to the multi-trillion dollar daily currency markets, and then of course maybe, you know, we're looking at hundreds of trillions if you add the currency, stock, and bond markets together. Are you a proponent or at least a believer that this revolution, Bitcoin and others, will pose a threat to the fiat money system? People will, within 5 years or less, they'll be looking for cryptocurrencies instead.
I'd be surprised if you see that in that time frame. I mean, down the road, there are any number of things that are going to happen, and I can't tell you that I can give you a really meaningful prediction. At this point in time, I would be very cautious there. I'd view the cryptocurrencies as like playing at a casino. You want to put some money in it, that's fine, but don't bet more than you can afford to lose. Frankly, I prefer physical gold. It has a traditional value there that's been established over thousands of years, and it's not subject to destruction by an electromagnetic pulse.
So you're sticking with your well-established thesis that we will see maybe Venezuela-style inflation that takes a little more than a year or so to unfold. I mean, obviously, that country has been, and in Argentina, their neighbor, have been plagued with these inflationary bouts now for decades. It just seems to be a reoccurring theme. We haven't seen anything like that in 150 years. Could that be the event that catches our policymakers off guard? And how would you see that unfold in the next few years if it were to happen?
Again, you're looking at something there that's tied to the dollar. The rest of the world decides it doesn't want to have its money in the dollar, which could happen with a misstep by the Fed. And the Fed has made missteps in the past. And things are not in balance. They don't know how to get things into balance now, so anything they try may backfire. The dollar would be the proximal trigger there again. Flight from the dollar, you'd see a big spike in oil prices, domestic inflation. If you look at the headline inflation of the last couple of years, it's been basically a matter of gasoline prices. It'll go far beyond that. But as the dollar weakens, people don't want to hold the dollar. You'll see the eventually a very massive spike in inflation here. It can develop quickly. The government itself is long-term bankrupt. I mean, there's no way they can honor their long-range obligations here. That now, in terms of net present value of what they should have in cash today to cover everything they've said they're going to pay out to people in the way of Social Security and Medicare, so it's over $100 trillion. That's five times the size of our economy. It's 50% larger than the global economy. It just can't possibly be covered. So one of two things have to happen. Either they have to, and I'm talking now the U.S. government, has to take action to bring the system into solvent balance, or you're going to end up with what Alan Greenspan had suggested at the time of the downgrading U.S. debt a couple of years ago. He said, well, there's no risk of U.S. defaulting on its debt here because all its debt is in dollars, and we print dollars, and we can print as many dollars as we need to. Well, that's inflation. That's the way the world ends here, unless the politicians in Washington can find a way of bringing this under control. And you look at what's happened there the last couple of years, and even in the last couple of months, there's no indication there that there's anyone looking to seriously restore long-range solvency for the U.S. government. So ultimately, you know, you're going to end up with a worthless dollar. That's another word for inflation. Gold and silver are your primary hedges against that. They'll preserve the purchasing power of your assets over time.
Don't you suspect that they will just have a Monday morning revaluation? Suddenly find out that if you had $10,000 in the savings account or banking account, they're going to lop off a digit and you have $1,000.
They can do that, but it doesn't just a matter of redenominating the way you have prices. It doesn't really, by the time you're doing that, you've already lost the purchasing power. Let me put it this way. You had $100 back in 1900 before the Fed was founded. If you bought $100 in gold, you'd still have your $100. If you just left your money in dollars and didn't invest it otherwise, you get interest on it, which in theory would tend to cover inflation, you'd be looking at something like 20 cents left on your $100 today. That's how much inflation we've had in the last 120 years. And it's not much different if you look at it the last 100 years. Most of it's happened since the founding of the Fed, but the greatest part happened after Roosevelt abandoned the domestic gold standard back in the 30s. The reason he did that was he needed more money to try and pull the economy out of the Great Depression. But in doing that, he also created a lot of inflation. And so we've got a fiat currency doomed to inflation with it over time. It's just a matter of how quick. We've been buying time with the dollar here. I watch the dollar as that goes in the global markets. You'll also see its purchasing power sink very rapidly here, meaning higher inflation.
We appreciate your thoughts, and we'd like for you to tell people more about the ShadowStats website and all the great services you're providing, please.
So I have a website, shadowstats.com. I provide a weekly newsletter. It's available to subscribers. They can download it from the site. But there's also a lot of information on the site that gives you background on a great deal of what we've talked about here today. That's free to anyone who wants to look at the site. You'll see articles over on the right-hand side. Left-hand side, you see the headlines from recent newsletters. Back several months, those are all open to the public. We're always happy to have new subscribers. It's $175 a year, $89 for 6 months. If you've got any questions, you can find a way of contacting me on the website. Happy to communicate with you.
John Williams, thanks so much for making time for us today. Talk soon.
Thank you, Chris.